That's okay. I wanted to start a new series actually this week. It's a series that is going to be challenging. It's a series that, as I've thought and prayed over, it's made me uncomfortable, and I pray that it makes you uncomfortable as well. A guy named Michael Gorman has written several books on the topic of cruciformity, and in one of those books, he makes this statement. He says, "Faith is an inauguration into a community and into a life of dying, or cruciformity." The word cruciform, if you're not familiar with that, it just means cross-shaped. And I think when we read through the New Testament, it's really easy for us to see the cross-shaped life of Christ. And what I mean when I say cross-shaped, it's not just like the shape of the cross, but it's also like everything that Jesus did was influenced by the cross, by his ultimate goal for humanity. And so when we think of our own lives, I think it's more of a challenge. I know in particular with my life individually, it's a challenge for me sometimes to see my life as being cross-shaped. And so I think one of the questions that I ask as a leader in the church and as an individual is this what outsiders see when they look at our lives or when they participate in the community of faith? Do they see a group of people whose individual lives are cross-shaped? Do they see us serving, leading sacrificial lives, living a life that Jesus called us to live? Is that what they see? In Matthew chapter 16, verse 24, Jesus said this. This is just after, in both Matthew and Mark's account, this is just after Peter makes that great confession that Jesus is the Messiah, and then he turns right around because Jesus warns his followers, hey, I'm going to go to Jerusalem, and when I get there, I'm going to suffer, and I'm going to die. And Peter, the same Peter that's like, oh, you're the Messiah, the Son of God, he's like, no, don't, you can't, you're not going to die. And so Jesus rebukes Peter. And immediately after this rebuke, he says this, whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. When we stop and think about what the cross represents, it becomes very clear what Jesus was saying to his followers. Jesus was essentially telling us, those that desire to follow after him, that we must die to ourselves. We must die to our selfish ambition, our pride, our ego, and allow our new life found in him to be shaped by him, to be shaped by the cross. His character must become our character. His cares must become our cares. And so as we go through this series, we're going to focus on the characteristics, the actions, the attitudes that Jesus embodied when he walked among his followers on earth. And my prayer for all of us as we go through this and as we study Jesus a little bit more in depth is that we will become more aware of who Jesus really is and that we would become more like Jesus. So here's the big idea for today. And I would encourage you to write this down. I actually did, you know, Gabby was concerned this morning as to whether or not I actually finished the sermon for this week. But I even did one better. I got a YouVersion event put out there. It may have been late last night, but if you are following us on Facebook, you can go there and look. There's a YouVersion event that will allow you to follow along, take your own notes, and it'll have the main point on there and some scriptures that we're going to look at. So here's what I want you to write down. If you don't have the YouVersion event, YouVersion is there for you. This is the big idea. Returning to cross-shaped Christianity requires that we move away from a serve-us mentality to a life of service. All right, I want to repeat that. Returning to cross-shaped Christianity requires that we move away from a serve-us us mentality to a life of service. There's another account that Matthew and Mark both record in Matthew chapter 20 and Mark chapter 10. In Matthew, it's James and John, the mother of James and John, the sons of Zebedee. They come to Jesus, and the mother asks Jesus, makes this request, I want one of my sons to sit on your right and one of my sons to sit on your left. In Mark, Mark tells us that it was actually, it may have been James and John, but regardless that asked the question, regardless their mother was maybe put, you know, like good mothers do, go ask Jesus. And so they say, let us sit on your right and one on your left in your kingdom. And really what they're asking is, we want the positions of authority, right? We recognize you're the center, but put us on either side. We want to rule with you. And what Jesus does in this interchange is he points out the flaw in their thought process. Because he ends this section by saying, "For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." Now, if we go to the Gospel of John, we get a beautiful illustration of what Jesus actually meant when he talked about serving. He paints a picture of what true service looks like. So I want you to turn to John chapter 13. And we're going to look at a pretty lengthy section, verses 1 through 17. I'm going to read it from the NIV, and then I'm going to draw out some interesting points. And then at the end, I'll give you the opportunity to ask your questions. So John recorded it like this. It was just before the Passover festival. So this is now we're in that setting when Jesus is warning his followers, "Hey, I'm going to Jerusalem. I'm going to suffer, and I'm eventually going to die." And we're right on the cusp of all of this. It was just before the Passover festival. Jesus knew that the hour had come for him to leave this world and go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. The evening meal was in progress, and the devil had already prompted Judas, the son of Simon Iscariot, to betray Jesus. Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power and that he had come from God and was returning to God. So he got up from the meal, took off his outer clothing, and wrapped a towel around his waist. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash his disciples' feet, drying them with the towel that was wrapped around him. He came to Simon Peter, who said to him, "Lord, are you going to wash my feet?" Jesus replied, "You do not realize what I'm doing, but later you will understand." "No," said Peter, "you shall never wash my feet." And Jesus answered, "Unless I wash you, you have no part with me." "Then, Lord," Simon Peter replied, "not just my feet, but my hands and my head as well." Jesus answered, "Those who have had a bath need only to wash their feet. Their whole body is clean. And you are clean, though not every one of you." For he knew who was going to betray him, and that is why he said not everyone was clean. When he had finished washing their feet, he put on his clothes and returned to his place. "Do you understand what I have done for you?" he asked them. "You call me teacher and Lord, and rightly so, for that is what I am. Now that I, your teacher, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also should wash one another's feet. I have set an example that you should do as I have done for you. Very truly I tell you, no servant is greater than his master, nor is a messenger greater than the one who sent him. Now that you know these things, you will be blessed if you do them." Some denominations will take this account and they'll build a theology on foot washing and talk about how foot washing is maybe a sacrament within the church, and they practice that in their gatherings. And I don't think there's a problem with that. But I think there's more than just a prescription for foot washing going on here. This isn't John telling us that you know, in order to be a good follower of Jesus, you have to wash each other's feet. There's something really deep happening here. Jesus does something very interesting. And when he does this, he teaches us something very important. Now, what do you have to understand about what is unfolding here is that Jesus would have been considered the guest of honor under normal circumstances. He was the one that had a following. People would show up in droves just to hear him teach. People considered him a dynamic teacher. They came in flocks. And if this is the same dinner that the other gospel writers link to the Last Supper, not only did Jesus demonstrate service through washing feet, but Jesus actually prepared for the dinner to happen. He set it all up. And so what we see is that the guest of honor assumes the position of a slave and begins to wash his disciples' feet. Now, I want you to picture this for just a moment, because this is pretty profound. This is the master of the universe on his hands and knees, washing the filthy feet of his followers. So in the ancient world, this was a task reserved for slaves. And most Jewish people thought that even this task was too low for a Jewish slave. So most of the time, it would have been a slave that was of non-Jewish descent. This was their job. In this world, they're walking around with leather and rope sandals in a dusty, dry environment and sweaty feet. And Jesus gets up from the table and washes their feet. He gets up from the table and he serves those that are gathered at the table. You know, one of the things that I loved as a child were, especially on my dad's side, this happened all the time. We had huge family gatherings. We always had cookouts. We ate together. And it was always so enjoyable to be around the table eating and just having fun with family. As I've gotten older, I have realized that it takes a lot behind the scenes to make that cookout happen. Right? There's a generation of people who love to serve and cook and make food and watch others enjoy that. And unfortunately, now I see a generation of people who show up to these meals empty-handed. And they just expect to sit and eat. Most of us, if we're honest with ourselves, we are happy to be served. We like to be served. Our culture conditions us to be people that are served. When you go to a restaurant and sit down, you expect prompt service. The tip that you leave on the table ultimately reflects how well you feel you were served. What I recognize now as an older person is that the greatest joy in those family gatherings is not just having a seat at the table, but it's being a person that makes the people who have a seat feel welcome, feel valued, feel fed. And when we think about the church, and we think about some of the ways that the church is illustrated, especially in the New Testament, the community of faith is like we get to pull up and have a seat at the table of God. And everyone wants a seat at the table. And Jesus offers everyone a seat at the table. You know, one of the memes that circulates social media, and I think it's very interesting when you think about it, it just simply says Judas 8:2. You know, in the text that we read, we know Judas is the betrayer, but Judas still had a seat at the table. And one of the things that Jesus demonstrates is that while we are invited to sit at the table, the goal is not to stay at the table. Jesus moves from the table to serving the table. For whatever reason, in the American church, we've made the pinnacle of following Jesus sitting at the table. We've made the ultimate experience of Christianity sitting and being served. But if we want to return to a cross-shaped Christianity, it requires that we move away from a serve us mentality and enter into a life of service. The pinnacle of the Christian life is not showing up and sitting. The pinnacle of the Christian life is showing up and serving. If the master of the universe, Jesus, who had a hand in creation, is not too high to serve, then none of us should escape serving. But the statistics paint a pretty grim picture. And maybe Hannah's Creek is just slightly better than the average statistic, but not a lot. Because in the average church in America, 20% of the people do 80% of the serving. Let that sink in. 20% of the people do 80% of the serving. We are going to have a big opportunity coming within the next month. And we are going to need several people to step up and serve. I loved Don's prayer this morning. Don had no idea what I was talking about today, but the very first thing he asked was about service. As I was trying to do double duty, run a soundboard, and mentally prepare myself to talk. Because this is what's happening. This is a big announcement. And sometime in September, we're going to switch to two services on Sunday morning. We'll have a 9 o'clock and a 10:45. Because we anticipate that as summer winds down, and school gets back in session, and things go back to normal, the attendance is going to swell again, and we need to have room at the table. Because we have been operating for far too long with no room at the table. And what that means is not only do we have to make the table bigger, but some of us have to get up from the table and serve at the table. Being a cross-shaped church requires us to be a church of willing servants. We need more teachers, we need more greeters, we need more technology people, and so much more. And so this is my plea. Don't be content to sit at the table. Serving at the table is far greater. Serving at the table is such a greater blessing than sitting at the table. And coming on the heels of our summer with the Spirit, you all know that you have been given gifts, talents, abilities that were given for you to serve the community of faith. Find out what those are. Put those to use. and live a cross-shaped life. Be the image of Jesus, not only in this church, but outside of these walls in this community. We'll pray, we'll have a time of reflection, and then I'll take your questions and offer some responses. Father, thank you so much for demonstrating how humble you are in the person of Christ, that you would take on the form of a human, do the task of a slave, die a gruesome death for us to have a place at the table. God, I ask that you would stir our hearts. Help us to realize that while we have a place at the table, you call us to serve at the table. I ask these things in Jesus' name. Amen.